Home Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We brace ourselves for a wildfire anytime it's warm, dry, and windy. Well, all that's in the forecast for LA and Ventura counties this week. We'll hear how new, freshly signed California laws may help prevent and protect against wildfires. Plus, no more stressing over SATs to get into a UC, why the system might ditch that requirement for admission. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Before we start the show, I got to say how great it was to see so many of you out there this weekend at the KPCC LAist Open House. It was awesome to see all of you here. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you so much for your support. And for those who missed it, we always are going to have one next year, so make sure you make it your mission to come out. We'd love to see you. All right, coming up, we'll preview a few of the cases the U.S. Supreme Court will be tackling this term and find out what their outcomes might mean for us here in California. Plus, we'll also hear whether students applying to University of California campuses will need to keep taking the ACT or the ACT or the SAT. That conversation's coming up in about half an hour, so stay right here. First, though, weather forecasters predict two things in Southern California this week. One is the Santa Ana winds. They'll start kicking up on Thursday. The other prediction, hot, dry weather. Put them both together and you've got a recipe for wildfires. Now, this troubling combo comes on the heels of some major moves in California aimed at preventing fires and protecting those living in high-risk areas. Last week, Governor Gavin Newsom signed 22 wildfire-related laws. So what are they? And will they really keep everyone in California safe? We're going to get some answers from Sean Hecht. He co-directs the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA Law School. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you. Great to be with you, A.
All right. Now, there are a few key themes in the bills the governor signed last week. They include laws about power shutoffs, trees around power lines, the oversight of utilities. And many of these new laws are based on recommendations from a strike force that he assembled earlier this year. So give us an overview. What are some of the problems these laws seek to resolve?
So as many of your listeners will know, we've had some very, very severe fire seasons over the last few years here in California. And in fact, 15 of the 20 most destructive fires in the state's history have occurred since 2000. Many of these fires, or many of the most destructive fires, are caused by power lines that are maintained by utilities. And so a lot of the problems and the laws are related to those sets of questions. The Public Utilities Commission has been assigned the work of trying to address the wildfire risk that utilities pose. And their job, in part, is to make sure that utilities have robust wildfire reduction plans and that the state has good oversight over those plans. That's sort of the big picture. There's a lot of smaller issues that relate to that, including mitigating the effects of blackouts that occur when a utility might shut off its power lines in order to reduce fire risk on a particularly risky day. There's also several bills that relate to what homeowners can do, creating best practices and motivating homeowners to be creating defensible space around their home and building for resilience against fires.
Yeah, hardening of homes. That's one of the themes there. And many of these laws are based on lessons really learned from some of our most devastating wildfires in recent years. You mentioned some of that. And it has been overwhelming almost to be in California the last few years and think about all the damage. A big part of this, though, is the oversight of utilities. Why do you think, Sean, that's been prioritized?
Well, it's been prioritized largely because electrical utilities in particular do pose serious risks because they don't always maintain their lines in a way that reduces the risk of fire. We have many, many miles of power lines, in some cases through very remote areas of the state, that are dry and at risk for wildfires. And when there's an ignition in those areas, it can cause a really devastating fire. And so some of the very worst fires that we have resulted from utilities equipment. At the same time, these utilities are responsible legally for the damage that the fires that they cause creates. And that also creates some huge financial pain for utilities and some risk for the future of our electrical infrastructure itself as utilities struggle to figure out how to pay for this.
Now, another key theme is assistance to homeowners who make efforts to retrofit their homes to reduce fire risk. And I should mention that all of these new laws are in addition to the governor's plan to create a $21 billion fund that would help settle wildfire claims. Sean, does this say to you that tackling California's wildfire Wildfire Futures, really a multi-pronged effort right now.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of different aspects to the wildfire problem. There is the question of the risk that people in their existing homes have. There's questions about how fires get ignited and how to reduce that risk. There's questions about community planning for wildfires. And there's questions about where we build and why we build in areas that are risky.
We're talking to Sean Hecht. He co-directs the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA Law School. Now, Sean, lately there's been some criticism of the legislature's decision. Some scientific research shows that one of the biggest ways to prevent loss of property and life is to not build in fire-prone areas. Scientists have also concluded that 90% of California's fires are started by humans. Why do you think there's less attention that's been focused on limiting development in these areas?
We have a very long history, not only in California, but throughout the country, of local government control over who builds, where they build, and how they build in our communities. And so in California, we have decades and decades of experience at local governments managing the creation of new homes, which cuts against the state coming in and trying to address and solve those problems, even in situations where it might be really valuable or important to have the state stepping in. Local governments depend on new construction for their tax base and for various other reasons, and sometimes the decisions they make actually aren't the best decisions, at least in terms of wildfire, but also when you think about the need to create more homes closest to where people work, the need to reduce our vehicle miles traveled in order to address climate change. There's all kinds of reasons why counties and cities might not be building in ways that are good for the state as a whole. And yet, it's been very challenging to tackle that as a statewide issue.
Now, the question I'm sure a lot of people have at this point is, okay, after 22 brand new laws, will we be safer than we were in past years?
Yeah, so we will be safer in the sense that each one of these laws is likely to have a positive impact. Certainly, creating the conditions for our home building to be more resilient will be helpful. Creating the conditions for existing housing to be more defensible against fire will be very helpful. This bill package also includes some provisions that will increase the state oversight over the utility's own plans to reduce fire risk by trimming trees. All of that is likely to create safer conditions. Is it enough? Well, surely it's unlikely to be enough given the changing conditions that we have in the state. But each one of these bills at least takes a step in the right direction.
Sean, for you, what other steps do you think the state can take maybe to limit wildfire-related disasters?
Well, I agree with the point that you made earlier that having the state have more input into where building happens to be resilient to fires in the first place, I think could be a really important move. I do think it's politically very unlikely that the state is going to be able to step in and limit building in risky areas, but I think that's something that the state could do much more effectively. I think clearly trying to address some of the really key issues with the oversight of utilities is going to be a challenge for the state. Utilities have a lot of lines that are not well maintained. They don't all even have good inventories of their lines. And so over time, trying to fix that is going to be a really, really crucial issue for the state as it reduces fire risk.
That's Sean Hecht. He co-directs the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA Law School. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
And this just in, Pacific Gas and Electric, the main electricity provider for Northern California, has just issued an unprecedented notification saying it could potentially shut off power this Wednesday and Thursday for almost all of the Bay Area. That's right, all of the Bay Area, in an effort to prevent power lines and other utility equipment from sparking wildfires. Now, the shutoff watch covers 29 counties. More could be added as weather forecasts change. Warm, dry offshore winds from the northeast, known as Diablo winds, are predicted for the area both Wednesday and Thursday. And officials advise residents to charge your phones and other devices and also to have flashlights and backup power sources right on hand. We're going to keep you updated as this story develops. All right. right, moving on. A pair of new reports on health and homelessness suggests that a much larger percentage of the homeless population suffers from mental and physical health problems. Substance abuse disorders are also an issue, and that is reflected in the numbers local officials present to the public. One of the studies found that more than three-quarters of people living on the streets, not in a shelter, have a severe mental illness, including post-traumatic stress disorder. With us here to make sense of it all is KPCC's homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
All right. So I remember earlier this year when the homeless count came out, we were told only about one-third of the homeless population in LA County had a severe mental illness, including substance abuse. But these new studies seem to dispute that. What do they say?
Right. So when the LA homeless count numbers came out earlier this year, you're right. Local officials at LASA said that about 29% of the folks who are homeless in LA County had either a severe mental illness or struggled with uncontrolled substance abuse. LASA said that 71% did not. So now we have a new analysis that's out of UCLA and UC Berkeley that came out this weekend. It's a national survey of unsheltered homeless people living outside. And it estimates, it's using national data here, but it thought that about 78% of the people who are unsheltered have a severe mental health problem. And it estimated that 75% have an uncontrolled substance abuse problem.
That's a big difference. I mean, a lot higher.
Yeah. And then the LA Times did another analysis that came out this morning, and it basically found similar figures using, though in this case, different data.
So do we have any idea why the numbers are all over the place? Obviously, a lot of people outside are very sick, but these numbers, I mean, 29% ill, very different than 75% ill. That's a huge difference.
Yeah, it is. So when LASA said that 29% of people are mentally ill or dealing with substance abuse disorder, they did that using a demographic survey that was done at the same time that everybody went out to do the homeless census earlier this year. The LA Times, the thing is that number also includes people who are like kept in shelters too. So it's unsheltered and sheltered homelessness. So you have a bunch of people who are living in a shelter system in LA County, and then you have everybody else who is outside. The LASA numbers including both of those. Now, people who live in shelters are typically healthier than those who are outside because, well, they're not exposed.
Okay,
and then shelters,
you're
right. Shelters also typically don't allow substance use at all inside either, which is another part of it because, well, the LASA number, that's one-fifth of everybody who's outside. That's obviously going to skew the numbers. The Times analysis is also looking at the results of that demographic survey that was done the same time as the homeless count. And for now, I'm not exactly clear on how that analysis differs from LASA, but LASA isn't disputing it. LASA also has to follow a very strict federal prescription for how they report their data, which they haven't disputed it, so we shall see in the future.
Okay, now what about that UC study?
Right. The UCLA-UC Berkeley study is a little bit different because it's actually looking at case manager assessments of people who are living outside and have been for some time. The tool that homeless case managers use to prioritize who gets access to government help, it's called the Vulnerability Index. Mm-hmm. Now, different vulnerability scores qualify for different kinds of public assistance. So often, these case managers are assessing the very sickest people, the people who basically need the most public assistance to get back on their feet. Now, there's actually one other statistic from that survey that found that 84% of the people who are unsheltered in America and living on the street, they have a severe physical health problem, too.
And that sounds believable. I mean, I know from your reporting in the past that healthcare is virtually impossible to get if you are homeless.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think that's the big key point in all of these numbers, because when we as the general public were given different numbers, I think it becomes a point that we don't really know what's going on, but I think we do know what's going on. We can see people outside getting
the
sicker.
The eyeball test, yeah.
Right, and you see people getting sicker, and it just distresses everybody. And, I mean, that is right. When people who are outside, they're very sick, and like you said a second ago, they have no access to health resources. It's impossible to get to the doctor. You don't have health insurance that's going to cover you. And really, the only intervention at that point is when an ER takes you in, or when an ambulance takes you to the ER.
Damn.
And the thing that I want to underscore is that all of the physical mental health issues, the substance abuse, it all is made worse when you're living outside. It is not an appropriate place for somebody to heal. So like mental health in particular. So just one thing, you know, you're living in this fight or flight mode all of the time. You can't ever get a good night's sleep. You know, you get woken up every single time somebody with a loud muffler drives by. Okay, now repeat that sort of sleep deprivation of one night. Repeat it for a week or a month or a whole year. And that just corrodes on somebody's physical and mental health until they're, you know, I mean, we see what's happening to people. They're literally sort of dissolving in front of us, and it's so distressing. I mean, that's because somebody is living outside. If somebody was not living outside and exposed to the elements like that, that would not be happening. When people are living outside, they just get worse.
That's KPCC's Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks for the perspective.
Thank you.
All right, for better or worse, LA neighborhoods are constantly changing, constantly evolving. A lot of the time, economic forces are the driver of those demographic shifts. The immigrants that make up an area, whose identity often helps name the neighborhood, tend to be the ones that get squeezed out. Coming up, find out where in LA some folks decided that no, they were not leaving the neighborhood that they have always called home. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. LA's Chinatown has long drawn newcomers from China and Southeast Asia. In recent years, booming downtown development has been squeezing some of those immigrants out. But a growing number of residents are refusing to leave without a fight. KPCC's Josie Huang has a story of tenants in one building who have banded together.
On the outskirts of Chinatown, a white-haired woman of 70 paces outside a stucco building. Du Pham says in Vietnamese she's waiting for her eviction notice. Her building, 920 Everett Street, was just sold to a new owner. American Collateral Buyers has given tenants in the six units 60 days to move out. Today is the 60th day. Pham's got a headache just from all the worrying. She's in a two-bedroom with her daughter and two grandkids, $1,250 a month. The other tenants are Cambodian and Thai. Living here on the edge of Chinatown in Echo Park, they're near familiar food, jobs, doctors who speak their languages. Pham's sister and sister-in-law used to rent on this very street. They left as their families grew, but Pham isn't ready to go.
What do we want?
Affordable housing!
When do we want it?
Now!
A month earlier, the grandmother was among the tenants holding anti-eviction signs outside their building alongside housing activists. The activists are with Chinatown Community for Equitable Development. Du Pham's grandniece, Cherise Pham, reached out to the group after her relatives called her.
They're like, oh my God, we have to move. Like, no, you're not moving anywhere. Let's see what I can do.
Cherise Pham works in real estate, so she says she gets tenant rights.
Most landlord think, oh, we're Asian. You know, Asian not going to fight back. If I give them a notice, they're just going to leave because they don't speak English. No one going to help them.
LA's Chinatown, as we know it, was created by displacement. Residents were evicted from the old Chinatown in the 1930s to make way for the construction of Union Station. But over the last decade, its location by downtown has made it one of LA's trendiest zip codes.
I've been around Chinatown for like 40 years, and I've never seen development like this.
That's housing activist Craig Wong. He says developers are buying up properties and raising rents or evicting people. Meanwhile, affordable units are vanishing as agreements between developers and the city that kept rents low expire. He says displaced tenants will struggle to ever find as affordable a place. It's happening to Chinatowns across the country.
Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Seattle, San Francisco.
Across North America, really.
Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver.
Landlords are perfectly within their rights to make a profit, but as Wong sees it,
there's legal rights and then there's justice. And to us, the market and the laws don't provide for sufficient, decent housing for people in the community. And we will do what it takes to keep the community together.
This has meant helping tenants stage protests outside their building, in Chinatown or nearby Lincoln Heights and Echo Park. In the last year, the housing activists and tenants have also been driving crosstown to where their landlords live.
Landlord, come high! Open the door!
A couple weekends ago, the tenants of 920 Everett Street showed up in Brentwood. They still hadn't gotten their eviction notices and were anxious. Dufam and the other elders sat on folding chairs and held signs outside the home of Lalit Kotari, who's named as a principal of American Collateral Buyers, the owner. The tenants go to Kotari's front door.
Just please open the door for us. Just talk to us, please.
That's Kinwe Un, a refugee from Cambodia. She works at a casino as a dealer. She's been living at 920 Everett for 15 years.
We not come here to harm you all, guy. We just come here to for pay the rent for next month to live. That's all. We came here no harm at all.
Minutes later, the police are called. Kotari comes out to meet the tenants, accompanied by his wife and the police. He tells me he doesn't want to be recorded. He says he had nothing to do with 920 Everett Street, that it was his estranged son who bought it. I asked him to pass on my number to his son. I haven't heard from the son, and the property management company for the building hasn't responded for comment. After a brief back and forth, the tenants leave the property with their rent checks in hand. Dufam says she doesn't buy Kotari's story. But a few days later, some good news. The tenants get a letter from the management company telling them how to pay their rent. This past weekend, Pham and other tenants dropped off their rent checks in person, and they were accepted. That means evictions have been averted. Victory, at least for now. I'm Josie Huang.
All right, turning to the courts, today's a big day for all the Supreme Court watchers out there. It's the first day of the new term. The justices have a docket filled with cases that have made headlines recently, and there's a few coming up that'll affect California in particular. Now, with us to break this all down is Jennifer Chacon. She's a law professor at UCLA. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, now, before we get into how California is likely to be affected, tell us about the biggest cases on the Supreme Court schedule this term.
Well, I think there's a number of cases that look big and exciting this term after a much quieter term last year. One of the cases that I think everybody's keeping their eye on is the case challenging the Trump administration's rescission of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival programs. So that one will be very interesting to watch. Another are the cases involving Title VII's protections and whether it extends to discrimination on the basis of sexual identity, sexual orientation, gender identity. And one more case that will be of interest to a lot of court watchers will be the cases that are challenging abortion restrictions in Louisiana that look a lot like abortion restrictions that were struck down by the court in Whole Women's Health in 2016. So pretty much all the hot button issues that we can think about, immigration, gun regulation, the rights of the LGBTQ community, all of these things are on the court's docket this term.
And Jennifer, the one you mentioned right off the top, DACA, that's the one many Californians will be paying particular attention to. Why?
Well, I think California is the state that has the most at stake in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival case. When we're thinking about states, there are over 180,000 people in the state of California who have deferred action status under the Obama-era program. And so that means 180,000 people who have deferred action, plus all their employers, their family members, their teachers, their students, the people who rely on them for healthcare services. All of these people have something at stake in that case. So I think it's a big one for California.
What exactly will be decided in that case? And what's the background on how the Supreme Court might rule?
Well, so this is a case that involves a program that was announced by the Department of Homeland Security in 2012. And at that point, Janet Napolitano, who was then secretary of the department, said that they're for a group of young people who met certain criteria, were a certain age, and had come into the country without authorization. That group of people would be sort of taken off the table for purposes of deportation. So they had something that was known as deferred action status. And as part of this, they were also able to apply pursuant to regulation for work authorization. And so they were given this sort of deferral of action in their immigration cases, given the ability to lawfully work. They were not given any sort of formal immigration status or put on a path to citizenship. So it's sort of a halfway measure, but it's really all that could be done without congressional action. And for the last few years, those individuals every 2 years have to renew their application for deferred action. The department reviews it and reissues it. And the Trump administration, when it came in, Trump had both promised to do something for these young people, but also simultaneously threatened to revoke the Deferred Action Program. And in September of 2017, then-acting Secretary of Homeland Security Elaine Dukes announced the administration's revocation of the Deferred Action Program, and they were sued. And so the case that's coming before the Supreme Court now is the culmination of these lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's rescission of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA.
We're talking about the Supreme Court's upcoming cases with Jennifer Chacon, law professor at UCLA. Now, the LGBTQ case won't have a direct effect on California policy, but people here in the state are closely watching it. Any insight on how this will go?
So it will have a nationwide effect. The reason that California might be less impacted than other states is because California has state law protections for individuals who are discriminated against on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. And in the 28 states where there are no such protections, there will be a lot more vulnerability to discrimination if the Supreme Court decides, in this case, that the sex discrimination provisions don't protect those individuals. And so that's what's at stake here. The question is whether Title VII's protection against sex discrimination applies to individuals who are discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation, their gender identity. And the question really in some ways boils down to what is meant by sex discrimination. And it's a question that the court has answered before in 1989 in a case called Pricewaterhouse versus Hopkins. The court decided that a case where a woman brought a discrimination suit because she said her employer expected her to wear makeup and behave femininely had been discriminated against on the basis of sex. And the Supreme Court agreed. They said that was sex discrimination. And in much the same way, the gender identity protection cases and the sexual orientation protection cases are bringing claims about employer expectations about how people are supposed to act on the basis of sex. And so I think the question here is whether the court is going to continue to extend those protections here.
Any important cases that are not on the court schedule right now, but may be added soon, that could have a direct impact on California?
Well, I think one of the cases that has been attracting attention in California, all over many places in the West, is the case involving homelessness ordinances. So I believe it's Martin versus City of Boise is the case. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit found that a Boise ordinance that criminalized homelessness effectively said that people could be arrested for sleeping unhoused was a constitutional violation, violated the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And California obviously is confronting a wave of homelessness and using a variety of tools to confront it, including criminal ordinances. And so I think there's a lot of interest in how that case, should the court decide to take it, would be resolved.
That's Jennifer Chacon, law professor at UCLA, talking about the Supreme Court's upcoming cases. Jennifer, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Stressing over taking the SATs. So many students have worried themselves sick over it, while some parents have been driven to break the law over it. You might not have to freak out about them much longer, especially if you want to go to college in California. Coming up, find out why you might not need to stress out over the SAT to get into a UC. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. To get into college, taking the SATs or ACTs is a necessary rite of passage. It's been that way since World War II, and nowadays, some high schoolers spend hundreds of dollars on tutors and test prep courses just to get a good score. But that could change for students who want to get into the state's prestigious UC schools. There's a task force currently looking at whether to do away with the SAT-ACT requirements in admissions. And their work got an extra push when last month state lawmakers reacted to the college admissions scandal that rocked schools like UCLA and directed the University of California system to re-examine how test scores are used. Here to tell us more about the effort, we have the co-chair of that statewide task force, Eddie Como, associate professor of education at UC Riverside. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
All right. Now, we should note that your work got started before the college admission scandal broke, but why rethink standardized tests in the first place?
UC President Janet Napolitano, back in July 2018, decided that there was a need for us to review standardized testing, the role of standardized testing in UC admissions, given the national attention to many comparable universities moving to test optional. We view UC as sort of the bellwether for the nation. So why not think about ways to strengthen, advance, if necessary, the role of standardized testing? And I think this was largely the motivation behind President Napolitano's efforts.
Now, some students see these standardized tests as a very clear measure of their scholastic ability. It's easy to measure and compare one student to another because it's boiled down to a number. But what does that number not tell us about a potential student?
You know, most admission directors try to look at students within the context of opportunities. And so maybe standardized testing is more so measuring privilege. If you're able to, you know, get access to advanced academic coaches and preparatory programs, it may advance the possibilities of getting a desirable score. And so when you do have a standardized test, that should not be the sole measure.
Then what are some of the other measures of a student that are just as important as a test score?
We rely on traditional indicators such as GPA. You know, GPA is something that's tracked over the course of 4 years of a student's high school experience. And so that is certainly a strong predictor of success in their first year. Other things that we tend to look at has to do with, say, for example, their resiliency, their self-efficacy, their creativity, their special talents, involvement in extracurricular activities, involvement in clubs, organizations, pre-college or in high school. You know, these are certainly part of the UC's 14 criteria for admitting students. But, you know, what tends to get most of the attention are standardized tests and GPAs.
So then how concerned are you then about cottage industries that have been set up to ace these tests that we've been talking about, where families might spend a lot of money, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, just to prepare for these tests?
Again, there is well-documented evidence that standardized tests are a measure of privilege. If you are in the more affluent districts, if you have access to academic coaches and test prep, it's likely that you would be advantaged when it comes to taking this particular test. So the question then becomes fundamentally, how do we ensure that a test that may privilege certain students, how do we ensure that it's more equitable and we're moving in a direction that, you know, may account for standardized tests, but also consider other factors where we're certainly not excluding certain students who are high achieving, gifted, and talented, but may not have access to the same opportunities that others are afforded.
We're talking to Eddie Como, Associate Professor of Education at UC Riverside, co-chair of a state task force to investigate the use of SAT and ACT scores in UC admissions. Now, your task force isn't expected to issue out a report of your findings until the spring, but let's talk about some of the possible outcomes here. And one is not to dump the test completely, but instead maybe change what's tested or accepting a different kind of test. Eddie, what's your team looking at?
As I mentioned earlier, we're in the preliminary stages. And so as of now, we don't have a position. Okay. We're trying to be objective in the way in which we think about this. But, you know, we actually have a meeting today to talk about some of the other content experts that we think would inform and help guide our discussions and ultimately our recommendations. And so we're putting those invites together to make sure that we have as much information as possible while simultaneously thinking about recommendations that we can present to President Napolitano.
And ultimately, Eddie, the tough part is maintaining UC's high academic standards, yet at the same time make access to enrollment equitable. It seems like it would be tough to do both.
Right. Well, there's a way. We certainly want to imagine a UC where students who historically have been excluded, we want to ensure that the process by which we think about admitting students is fair and equitable. And so I see it as a challenge, but I don't see that as impossible to think about a metrics that could work for a wider range of students if, in fact, we believe that students are being shut out of this process.
All right. One last thing, Eddie, considering that you said that you're still in the first few stages of this, but there are young students listening right now, maybe years away from taking the test. What's your message to them about how to make themselves a better college candidate?
As always, with any student, you want to expose yourself. Sometimes you have to put yourself in uncomfortable positions in order to have some level of success. So the more students can expose themselves to a variety of resources, of knowledge bases, and be able to stretch their knowledge base in ways that would, you know, contribute to a more well-rounded person, I think is important.
Betty Como, Associate Professor of Education at UC Riverside, co-chair of a state task force to investigate the use of SAT and ACT scores in UC admissions. Eddie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, staying with education, imagine being a child trying to keep up with schoolwork as your migrant parents move from place to place to keep up with harvest throughout the state. To help educate the children of migrant farm workers, California offers special programs. But as Katie Orr reports for KQED, enrollment in those courses has fallen in recent years.
During a STEM camp at the San Joaquin County Office of Education, groups of kids delicately build towers out of playing cards perched on small tabletop earthquake simulators.
And then we're going to put one of these right here, one of these right here.
Their teacher comes around and turns on the simulators one by one, and the kids wait breathlessly to see which group's tower will stand the tallest after the shaking stop.
All right. We got our wins right here. Nice job.
There are about 30 elementary school kids in this camp, all of them children of farm workers. The federally funded migrant education program offers extra instruction after school and on breaks to kids who might otherwise fall behind in school as their families move around with the harvest. But this region's director, Manuel Nunez, says the number of kids enrolled has fallen dramatically over the years.
When I first started back in 01, I started with this region, we had about 21,000. Currently, we're at about 2,200. So that's a huge drop off.
The reasons are complex. It's getting tougher to qualify for this help. Parents are taking different jobs. And then there's the political atmosphere. Nunez says under the Trump administration, many migrant families are reluctant to sign up, even if their children could benefit.
Many times when we have staff go out and they're talking to families and interviewing them to qualify for the program, they're hesitant to give us information, especially because they know we're a federal program.
Nunez says they don't ask about immigration status, but he's seen a decline in parent involvement. Veronica Aguilar with the California Department of Education says migrant ed programs across the state are seeing the same thing and are trying to reassure families.
Just informing them of their rights, their ability to say no to someone that knocks on their door. As long as they don't give them entrance to their door, they can't do anything.
There are currently 82,000 students getting help from migrant ed classes across the state. For the California Report, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
Yogi Berra was a Hall of Fame catcher for the Yankees, 10 World Series titles, more than any other player. But most of you may know him better for his many malaprops, his yogiisms, the most famous, "It ain't over till it's over." When it comes to Disneyland's Galaxy's Edge, I wanted to visit and experience it, but I haven't because I figured, as Yogi once quipped, nobody goes there, it's too crowded. Coming up, why only half of that phrase is right. Find out which half when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Before it opened this past May, Disneyland's Galaxy's Edge could not have seemed more exciting. Happiest Place on Earth was about to open a brand new 14-acre land filled with Star Wars iconography and experiences like the Millennium Falcon ride, a build-your-own lightsaber workshop, even a cantina selling blue milk. But then it opened, and the crowds, well, they just didn't show up. So what went wrong, and what did the park get right? Todd Martins is a staff writer with the LA Times, who's been writing about the hits and misses of Disneyland's Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. Todd joins us now. Welcome back.
Okay, good to be back.
All right, now the reason we wanted to talk to you is you just don't report about Disneyland. You're also a fan. So tell me, how many times have you been to Galaxy's Edge since it opened in May?
You know, well, probably been to Disneyland pretty much almost every week since it opened. It's been about 9 days since I've been there, and that's kind of a long stretch for me, so without being at the park.
Well, I like baseball, but I wouldn't go to the Dodger game every single week if I could, but you're you, Todd. All right, so your article is titled Disneyland, a Disney Star Wars, Galaxy's Edge, What Works, What's Missing, and What to Fix. So let's start with the positive. In your opinion, Todd, what is working?
Well, the land is gorgeous. It feels like a real place. It feels lived in. It feels unlike anything else at Disneyland. It actually, you walk around every turn. There's something to see. You're fully enveloped in this world. If you're familiar with Epcot in Florida, you know, they have those little simulations of foreign countries.
Oh, yeah.
Galaxy's Edge sort of reminds me of that. It's a taste of a foreign culture.
And what about the Millennium Falcon that's there?
The Millennium Falcon is a gorgeous piece of architecture in the center of the land. You see it if you've been a Star Wars fan. I think you see everybody comes and just kind of stops and stares at it for a moment. And the queue is amazing. There's this big sort of Instagram-worthy, sort of photo-worthy sort of moment. You know, if you remember the chess game from...
Yeah.
You know, so you can hang out in that room for a few minutes. And the actual simulator, it's an impressive piece of interactive technology. There's no other ride like it at Disneyland. It's a full video game spun to life.
So emotionally, it hits all the right buttons, right? It seems like it does.
I would say, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a lot of fun, and yeah. I've definitely enjoyed the ride. It's a little bit more plot story-based than some of the other attractions. If you think about Pirates of the Caribbean or the Haunted Mansion, those are more sort of experience-based and more sort of you're in this sort of world. The Millennium Falcon, you know, if you like video games, if you like sort of press this button to do this, go here, go here, do that, you'll definitely like it. But it's a different sort of experience than if you're thinking the fully immersive, emotional, sort of all-enveloping sort of ride.
So then what's missing then from the new land?
Well, so a couple things. First of all, I mean, you have to say the land isn't finished. So the showcase ride of the land is scheduled to open in early January in Anaheim and December 5th in Walt Disney World. So that's Rise of the Resistance, and that's a 15-minute plus sort of escape from an Imperial starship. It's definitely what Imagineering has talked up as one of Disney's most sort of experimental and ambitious rides, and I think it will live up to that sort of hype. I think when it opens, the land will feel much, much more full of life.
Much more. Okay, now in your story, you say that a lot of the characters who are supposed to interact with visitors just seem like they don't want to talk or interact.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess if you sort of think of when you go to Disneyland, if you walk in Main Street, sort of when you walk into the park, you see vehicles, you see horses, you see a band, you see vocalists, you see artisans working in the shops. So there's a real sense of like a place, a sense that you're someplace else, it's theater. So Galaxy's Edge does lack that sense of movement. It lacks sort of those characters. They've been trying to have their cast members sort of pretend to be Batuu residents. Batuu is the fictional planet where Galaxy's Edge is set. And I think the cast members like sort of playing with guests. The problem is the cast members also have a job to do.
Okay. So it's not really what they're there to do then. Is that the kind of the rub there?
Sort of, you know, so it's, if the selling point is that each person in Batuu has a backstory. So it's like, you can go up to somebody pouring blue milk and ask them where they're from, what they've lived, how long they've lived on this planet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Your mileage will vary sort of depending on how crowded the park is at the moment and how busy people are and just sort of how good of an improviser somebody is.
We're talking to Todd Martin, staff writer for the LA Times, talking to us about the hits and misses of Disneyland's Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. You mentioned how the other part, Rise of the Resistance, won't be open until January. In some ways, should we all maybe refrain from kind of coming down on the place until it's really nice and complete?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, that ride is really going to change the feel of the land. I think that ride is going to be unlike anything Disney has done. And I think a lot of people are probably waiting for that ride. If you're not an annual pass holder and you only go to Disneyland once or twice a year, it makes sense that you would hold off in visiting until that ride is open.
And do you think that's why maybe crowds haven't been as big for Galaxy's Edge as a lot of people thought they might be, waiting for the whole thing? They want to experience the whole thing complete and not have to piece together the experience little by little.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, I mentioned in my story that a week before Galaxy's Edge opened, I was at the park for a couple of days, and it was just insanely crowded. It was too packed for me to do anything. So I don't think people suddenly stopped being fans of Disneyland. I think there was a fear that once Galaxy's Edge opened, the park was just going to be so filled with people that it was going to, you know, come to a halt. So I think a lot of people just stayed away out of fear of crowds, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's expensive to go to Disneyland, so a lot of people are also waiting for that second ride.
Did Disneyland do a good enough job at kind of getting people's expectations about how crowded it would be clear? In other words, because I always thought that, well, it's going to be so crowded that no one's going to want to go. I'm not going to want to go. I'll wait till it all calms down. It could be years before I even show up. That's what I had in my head.
Well, yeah, I mean, and Disney sort of fueled that a little bit. If you think earlier this year, you know, they sort of staged a pretty public campaign to sort of talk about how they were widening the pathways, flattening curbs, just making the park easier to navigate for people. So that alone, I think, created the sensation or the belief in people's minds that the park was just going to be really insanely crowded once Galaxy's Edge opened.
Now, okay, on the positive side, what else can people look forward to as Disneyland's Star Wars Galaxy's Edge evolves?
Well, I think as it evolves, you know, Disney keeps talking about, you know, there's going to be elements that they're going to add. So, you know, some of the interactive elements that they've talked about haven't come to fruition. You know, they've talked about how, you know, if you're in the cantina, you know, a smuggler may tap you on the shoulder. You know, that hasn't happened yet. So, you know,
you haven't been tapped on the shoulder yet, Todd? My goodness.
Not yet. You know, the hope is that they will continue to add more characters. You know, they've teased that eventually droids will be moving about the land. So I think, as you know, theme parks are sort of a living, breathing art form that, you know, change daily and monthly. I think as those things are added to the land over time, it will really start to feel like you are in, you know, the Star Wars universe that was promised.
I think if you dress like an intergalactic smuggler, then maybe a smuggler will tap you, Todd, at some point. It's your fault, Todd. Don't you know that? Todd Martins is staff writer for the LA Times, talking to us about the hits and misses of Disneyland's Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. Todd, thanks for taking the time. We're going to check back in with you when this thing gets more full and put together.
Sounds great.
All right, and we close today with an occasional segment we call Here in SoCal. That's H-E-A-R in SoCal, where we bring you some iconic sounds of the city. Years ago, Carlos Santana brought Latin jazz to the masses at the Woodstock Festival in upstate New York. And over the weekend, that legacy lived on through the Highland Park Latin Jazz Festival in Sycamore Grove Park, where Santana frontman Andy Vargas was performing with his band Soleros. It was part of a free two-day lineup featuring more than a dozen local acts like the one you're hearing right now, the Boogaloo Assassins. The band is from Los Angeles and played Saturday night. City Council member Gilbert Cedillo represents the area and pioneered the fest 6 years ago as an event that is of, by, and for the community. And now, a lot has been made about the gentrification of Northeast LA in recent years, but the Highland Park Latin Jazz Festival showed that the community's Latin heritage is alive and well and being enjoyed by the full spectrum of Angelenos who now call the area home. All right, if you missed any part of the show, what are you doing? You know we're on at 2. Come on. Get it going. We're on at 2 o'clock every single day, but if you missed it, I'm not coming down on you. Don't worry about it. I'm too appreciative of your listenership to come down on you. But if you missed any part of the show, you want to hear it, we're right there where you find your podcast. Just look for Take 2, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take 2. I'm there as well, at A. Martinez LA. That's at A. Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.